2FM.
Welcome along, Dave Kelly here in for Marie. It's Tuesday the 16th of May and this is Game On. Coming up, Ireland's Sevens captain Lucy Mulhall joins us live after the girls in green qualified for the Paris Olympics.
Can Flat get there first? Yes! And the penalty! And that'll do it! That will be enough for Ireland!
Massive moment. She shot her shot. She kicked, but kicked territorial leg. Mulhall kicks it into the stands and he's off to Paris 2024 for these women.
Ireland are going to Paris! Book your ticket!
Unreal moment. Look at what it means to these women.
Yeah, magic moment it was. And we'll be sticking with rugby because Bernard Jackman is in studio to start our build-up to the Champions Cup final. And in golf, we'll hear from Rory McIlroy as he aims for major glory this week at the US PGA after a really disappointing week at the Masters.
It wasn't really the performance of Augusta that's hard to get over. It's just more the mental aspect and the deflation of it and sort of, you know, sort of trying to get your mind in the right place to start going forward again, I guess.
And in the Champions League, one Milan side will reach the final tonight as AC Milan take on Edin Dzeko and Inter Milan.
You're playing away, but you're still playing at home. It's a very different second leg, isn't it?
It is. I mean, like I said before, just on the paper, we played an away game today, obviously with more their fans. But we are lucky that in the second leg there will be much more our fans. So hopefully they'll give us even more energy for that second leg.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
So, Bernard Jackman is live in the Game On studio this evening to look ahead at the Champions Cup clash between La Rochelle and Leinster this Saturday live from the Ovidio Stadium. But, gentlemen, before we look forward, I think we should look back. And I really enjoyed Monday Night Football last night, listening to Howard Webb as they replayed the referee and the VAR referees or gentlemen and ladies in the VAR studio and how they came to reach the decisions they were making. I thought it was really interesting. I know they do it in rugby, Bernard. I just can't understand why they don't do it more often.
Yeah, it was brilliant, wasn't it? And just to get that insight, I used to love from your sport when you could hear the stewards' inquiry and what was being said and what the jockeys were saying. I think it added to the level of understanding for the pundit. But just seeing the complexity, the detail, the way they communicated for those decisions, I think it was a big help. I think it helps the fans understand how difficult it is, and obviously there's been a few high profile errors this year by VAR, and probably would have been, you know, in hindsight, if they could have looked at one of those and kind of shown how it was got wrong, I think that might have helped or even made it even better. But yeah, just any insight we get into decision making and officiating, because let's be honest, like even from our sport, rugby, coming out of the Viva Stadium, all people were talking about was the referee at the weekend, whereas my good feeling watching it live was, you know, he didn't really decide the game. But at the moment, that's the focus point for so many fans post a result, particularly if your team loses.
Funny enough, I watching it last night, they did show how Brentford got a penalty and that VAR was wrong because the Bournemouth defender, the Brentford striker actually fouled the Bournemouth striker first. So they did.
Yeah, no, that was one that they got, but there was the ones that jumped to mind to me are the Arsenal had a good goal against Brentford. The VAR didn't draw the line properly. There's been a couple during the year, but look, if they can make that a regular feature or once a month go back and show some of the contentious results, or I think it'll definitely help the fans understand how difficult it is. And I remember when I was in France, French referees were getting a hard time for a while, or we're dropping off the radar a little bit in terms of getting international recognition, and they rejigged the referee coaching course. And I remember part of the coaching for referees, professional referees, involved fight simulators to try and get them to be able to deal with pressure situations differently, hostage negotiators coming in to help them communicate better. So it's not an easy job, refereeing, and I suppose any way they can train them up a little bit better, because the game is getting faster, all the games are getting faster and harder to referee.
Funny you mentioned racing there, Bernard, and me, for me anyway, listening to two jockeys pleading their case in the show room when I know, one is probably fabricating the truth as much as he can, and one is probably trying to make the story look as well as he can for him or her, I often think it's actually the stewards I want to hear. It's not the jockeys. How did they come to the decision? Do we really want to hear the striker and the defender or the second row and the out half? It's how the referee and the TMO or the referee and the VAR come to their decision. Whereas in racing, we never hear why the stewards are coming to their decision. We just hear the jockeys pleading their case.
Yeah, do you think that could ever be something that we brought in and looked at?
Definitely. I think it would be great anyway, so I would. Any opinion,
I'm just
Dave?
Wondering as well, do you think something like last night would maybe lead to people watching the games having a greater appreciation of the match officials?
Could do. It would also, probably some will argue, it'll lead to even less debate because we'll have all the answers. So when you come out of a match now, you have a big row over what the referee did or didn't do. But if you get all the answers straight away, maybe you won't have the same debate. I don't know. I definitely thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think it's the way forward for sport. I just wish racing would hurry on and catch up. Soccer are catching up with rugby. I'd love to see racing go and catch up with them all, personally.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt it was a really interesting insight. I thought Howard Webb spoke so well. And as you said, Ruby, the fact that they were able to give all these examples and take you through these examples in a really detailed analysis to see exactly how they come up with these really important decisions was great television.
It most certainly was. No, we are here to discuss rugby, and we did have a big, massive performance at the weekend from the women's sevens, and Lucy Mulhall, I believe, is coming to join us this evening. We're just testing Lucy's line there. I went too soon, as usual. Typical of a jockey. Don't know where the winning post is. But anyway, Bernard, it was some weekend for the women's rugby, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was brilliant, and I can't wait to hear the relief and the excitement that Louise has and Lucy has, and also her teammates, because this has been a journey for them. There's times when it didn't look like it was going to happen, and to get us under the pressure they were under last weekend must be massive for them
down in Toulouse, and some journey they've been on. You look at where they've been around the world this year: Dubai, Cape Town, Hamilton, Sydney, Vancouver, Hong Kong, to round up in Toulouse. Doesn't sound like the worst trip in the world though, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. That's one of the big attractions of the Sevens is obviously the travel, the stadiums they play in. Obviously, it's a phenomenal sport to watch, and it's growing in popularity. You'd love to see a leg come to Dublin at some time. I think the atmosphere in the Aviva and the opportunity to grow the game would be massive, and you'd like to think the World Rugby and the powers that be will try and get that in the schedule at some stage.
We have Lucy on the line now. I think Lucy, obviously, fantastic achievement at the weekend, and I'd imagine it's been an enjoyable last couple of days for you and the rest of the squad.
Yeah, it's been great, as you can hear from my voice. I've maybe had too good of a time, but it's been really, really enjoyable for us. And yeah, there was a time there where we made it very difficult for ourselves, but just to get over the line is amazing. 9 years in the making, so yeah, incredible.
It's a great news story, Lucy, for women's rugby in Ireland. When you think of the Six Nations, it's a boost that the sport, and it's the same sport, whatever way you look at it, it's a boost that the sport really needed.
Yeah, totally. We just want to grow women's rugby. It doesn't matter whether it's sevens or 15s. And to think that there'll be young girls watching, whether it be last weekend or Paris 2024, and might pick up a rugby ball for the first time because of it, that's really, really special.
Sounds like you had a good party, Lucy.
Yeah, I might have sang a few too many songs last night, I think.
What did you
say?
Well,
that's a good thing. You have to enjoy it, don't you, Birch?
Absolutely, yeah. Jeez, 9 years. And this group have obviously finished off what others have started. And the celebrations needed to be big because it's a huge achievement. Lucy, what's next for your season now? Is that the end of it, or is there any more legs of the sevens?
No, we have the Europeans coming up there in June, and then we'll get a bit of an off season before the World Series leading into Paris.
Not so bad. Preparation wise, then obviously the Europeans will bring you into the winter time, and then you'll be back into the World Series again before you get to the Olympics, even not the World Cup. But obviously, it was the target. It was the goal. You've gotten there. How satisfying is
it? Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. Funny, I haven't felt peace. I think in the last couple of months we've just been working so hard to try get it done, and it just feels great now. And it's going to be nice to have a year to try grow the game, get some exposure of sevens in the country before Paris as well.
Did you ever think you'd be an Olympian?
No, not when I was playing GA back at home all those years ago. It's amazing. Please God, I do end up getting there.
Oh, I know. Obviously, look, I mean, it comes to picking a squad for the world, for the Olympics, even who knows who'll be on it. But to even think that you're part of a team to qualify for an Olympics is such an achievement. When you look back through all the qualifying rounds, all those wonderful cities I mentioned to Bernard a minute ago, which was your favourite? Which place did you go and you thought, wow, that was an incredible tournament?
Last weekend, obviously, was very, very special. Our families being there was probably... It's something I'm never going to forget ever, not just because we qualified, but we had over 100 people over there, which for sevens, we don't get that very often. So, yeah, Toulouse, and then I love Sydney as well. I got to see my brother, who I hadn't seen in over a year, so that was really special as well.
The Sydney, Hamilton, Cape Town, was that all one block together, or did you go down and come back for those three legs?
Sydney and Hamilton were together, and then Cape Town and Dubai before Christmas.
Before Christmas. And obviously you got great results. You were fourth in Cape Town and Hamilton. Was the continuity of that time, was that a big help?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And then I guess the favourites, the label, of being 16 points ahead, maybe got into our heads a little bit, and we dropped off for Hong Kong and Vancouver. But look, once we got over the line eventually, then yeah, we left it down to the last game and 2 points going into Toulouse. But you were very fortunate that we did start the season so well.
And we look at the teams that haven't qualified: Fiji, Great Britain, Canada, Spain, Brazil, some huge sevens nations there. Like, it was a tough competition. This wasn't a give me, was it?
No, never. And up until this season, it was never even conceivable that we would think that we'd qualify through the series as a top four. So yeah, it's to get first time round and not have to wait till next year or not have to go through Europe is really special. And it's definitely going to help for Europe as a continent, because it's so competitive that we got to qualify as well.
And Lucy, talk to me a little bit about how much you're looking forward to being part of Team Ireland as a whole. And obviously you're representing the rugby, the sevens is the event you're competing in, but to be part of the overall Team Ireland at an Olympics.
Yeah, how special. I've watched it over the years, and it's a very elite group of people, and I'm so honoured that we will get to stand there and have women's rugby players within that group, but then to get to stand alongside incredible athletes and represent our country at what probably is the pinnacle of sport. So yeah, I get shivers even thinking about it now.
I'm sure you do. Lucy, there's no way I'm going to be the one that denied you a second night's party, so thanks a million for taking my call. You've deserved it. I hope you're not pulling stumps already, so please go and enjoy yourselves. I think it's an incredible achievement. And thanks a million for taking the time to come on the phone to join us this evening.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it, and appreciate you giving Rugby Sevens the platform on the radio as well. Thank you.
Not at all, Lucy. And if we didn't get you on, Marie Crowe would have our guts for garters, Dave Kelly, wouldn't she?
Absolutely. You could tell her.
Yeah, exactly. cheers, Lucy. Enjoy your night.
Thanks, Lucy.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Bernard, obviously it's a big weekend in the 15s game. Leinster are going to have to bounce back from that defeat to Munster to face Ronan O'Gara's La Rochelle. What do you think?
Ronan O'Gara did a press conference today, and I just listened into it. His French is phenomenal now, for one, but the way he spoke was brilliant. And some of the journalists were kind of saying to him, oh, how are you going to stop Leinster? And he said, no, how are they going to stop us? You know, we're the champions. We know it's going to be a hostile environment, but we're ready for this. We're hungry. And they asked him, you know, how could they conserve the title? He said, no, conserving is nonsense. It's re-winning it, you know, and winning it's fabulous, and we want that taste again. So I look back at the last two Leinster-La Rochelle games, and okay, they won with a last minute try last year, but they were full value for it, really. They took Leinster out of their stride, and the year before during COVID, obviously an empty stadium, but they were dominant. So the closer this game gets, I think the more of an even game it is. And obviously there will be a little bit of doubt in Leinster's mind now, even though obviously they obviously had a lot of key players not involved at the weekend, but losing to Munster ranks up the pressure massively on Leinster, because for them to finish back-to-back seasons without a trophy would be a shocking return for the level of performance that they've put in most weeks. But this business is about winning, and obviously to lose at home as well last year, it was obviously in Marseille, so certainly the pressure is on Leinster. They're still favourites, but it's a very hard game to call.
Well, as you say, it is of course a repeat of last year's final, and let's get some reaction from the Leinster cap now. Josh van der Fleer has been speaking to Michael Corcoran.
Are there things that you learned from last year's final? Okay, you lost, but did you feel perhaps you didn't play your best kind of as a collective group on the day? You didn't perform the way you should have, and you saw if you're a small bit off exactly what can happen or what can't happen?
Yeah, there's always things you can learn from games. I think it's particularly losses like the one last year in the final. Again, a lot of credit has to go to La Rochelle. They were brilliant, and this is their third final now, so they've been very, very good, but will definitely take a lot from it. I suppose one of the big things with knockout rugby, and especially games at the top end of Europe, it always seems to be small margins. It's one or two small bits of detail that can be the difference between winning and losing. So that was definitely the case last year. There wasn't much in it. It was bounce of a ball either way, a decision here and there, and that's what it comes down to. So it's definitely, we definitely know what to expect this year, and hopefully it'll bode us well having been through those experiences and probably learned the hard way.
You get a chance this weekend to run out in front of your friends and your family and playing what is probably the biggest club game of all. That's the reality. Okay, you've had the pleasure of doing it from an Irish point of view, but to do it with all the lads you've grown up and played alongside all the way through, I mean, that must be, it's like kind of boyhood dream stuff, really.
Yeah, it is. To play in front of home fans who've been unbelievable for us, not just this year, but as long as I've been a Leinster fan, which is pretty much all my life, it's been incredibly special to support Leinster, and I mean all those people who be there, family and friends, to each of us as individuals, that means a huge amount to us. And then of course, just the dream of getting to play in a European final, it's where you want to be.
Bernard, I suppose when it comes to any competition, when it gets to the final, ideally you want the two best sides competing in that final. Are these the two best sides in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. This is La Rochelle's third final in a row in the Champions Cup, which only two other teams have done. And they're actually in a Challenge Cup final in 2019. So it's incredible what they've done. You know, to come from Pro D2 in 2014 to now being, you know, up there with the teams with the best heritage in European rugby. There's only probably four or five who you could say are a real royalty in Europe. And O'Gara and John O'Gibbs before him have created this, I suppose, team and squad who are able to fight a battle on two fronts. They're second in the top 14. They'll be in the playoffs for that, and they're in the running for a double, which is incredibly difficult to do. Leinster have obviously failed to do it over the last couple of seasons. So, and also he's done it. I was just reading his report there, listening to his interview earlier. La Rochelle only have one injury. You know, to be at this stage of the season and to have that many players fit and available, fresh. He was able to rotate last weekend because they had enough of a buffer in the league. So they're coming here to play, and it is the two best teams in Europe. We thought the Leinster-Toulouse game would have been a real ding-dong battle, but Leinster blew them away, and obviously the red card and some injuries helped Leinster in that situation, or yellow cards helped in that situation. But This is different. Roger's been able to create a team who seem to revel in knockout rugby and know how to win. So, huge test for Leinster.
It's a massive test for Leinster. But if you look at who Leo Cullen can put in the pitch and who Ron O'Gara can put in the pitch, 1-15 or 1-22, which side would you have?
Look, you have to back Leinster over the course. I think as far as 23, I think O'Gara has got six or seven real match winners who you wouldn't bet against, but Leinster should have a little bit more depth off the bench. Now it's marginal, to be honest, and some of that's based, Ruby, on those lads winning a Grand Slam with Ireland. And normally when Ireland win a trophy, one of the provinces also back that up because the confidence that they get from, you know, closing the deal. But La Rochelle have the confidence from having obviously won this last year and beaten Leinster the year before. So they won't come here. A lot of teams come to Dublin and they don't really believe they can win, whereas I just can't see that when I look at this La Rochelle team, because the evidence is there that they can.
When you look at the different matchups, there's going to be Skelton versus Ryan, but Aldred versus Jack Conan, even scrum half Gibson Park and Cara Barlow, out half Hastoy and Ross Byrne, like all across the pitch there's going to be massive clashes.
Yeah, massive clashes, and to be honest, La Rochelle are actually better this year at halfback. Kerbarlo was injured last year, and Hastoy was playing for Poe. He's been an unbelievable recruit by Ronan Nogara, and as a halfback partnership, they're absolutely flying. But obviously, you know, Gibson Park is outstanding. Ross Byrne has shown that he can step up to replace Sexton. James Ryan has been in great form, but Skelton has done serious damage to Leinster in the past. I think Dan Sheehan against Bougerie, two very dynamic hookers, is going to be really interesting. Andrew Porter against Antonio, two massive men. Antonio and La Rochelle have got on top of Leinster scrum in the past. Dante is back from injury. He played last weekend and he's going to be a boost. And then Levani Bottia, the Fijian, former Fijian captain, who plays seven or centre. He's just been a menace at the breakdown. And Munster got after Leinster at the breakdown and took them out of their stride. And certainly this year, in terms of defensive breakdown, La Rochelle have been the best team by a mile. So what Leinster are going to face this weekend is different than they do in a normal URC game or even a European game, and that's what makes it so fascinating.
You mentioned, Bernard, you were very impressed with Ronan O'Gara at the press conference today. He seemed quite bullish, and sure, why wouldn't he be? As a proud Munster man, what do you think it would mean to him to come to Dublin for his side to beat Leinster and be champions of Europe again?
Look, he's a winner. You know, wherever he's gone, whether it's, you know, he was part of the Racing team that won their first top 14. He went to the Crusaders, won two Super Rugby titles. He's led La Rochelle to a Champions Cup title. And look, his life has been a rival with Leinster, you know, from when he was young, probably when he was playing for Munster Schools. That was the game that got him going the most, playing for Cork Conn against Leinster clubs into the Red of Munster. And he was a big part of that rivalry and how it started. And, you know, he's gone to La Rochelle now. And just Murphy's Law, he's got to play Leinster quite a few times, you know, as a coach with La Rochelle. And he's got a team who can do him justice. So I think it'd be huge for him. Look, he's internationally recognised now as being one of the brightest coaches in the game. But to win a back-to-back European title, to beat this Leinster team, who many a month ago, and me included, maybe thought they were unbeatable at club level, it would be just another massive string to his bow.
I think we all kind of thought they were a little bit unbeatable, Bernard. But when they look back and reflect on last week and the team they chose, all their eggs are in the basket for this weekend now to win a trophy. Do they need that extra pressure?
Look, I think because of the outcome, you could question the decision. But I think beforehand, possibly you could have put a couple of lads on the bench and bring them on if we were needed. But I think when you look at it, like I met James Lowe before the game, and who looks like he's going to be fit for this weekend. He's only played four URC games this year. So when you look at the team that Leo picked, it is the majority of the players who've been playing week in, week out in the URC. And obviously they thought they had enough to win. They very close to did win the game. They went very close to winning the game. And it does put massive pressure on this week. But I think, Ruby, to be honest, if Leinster win a European title, that gamble was worth it, even though obviously they fell at the second last hurdle. But that gamble will be worth it because Europe is what it's been all about since 2018. They need that European title, I suppose, to show that they are the best team in Europe, which a lot of us think they are, but they haven't got the trophies to show for it. But if they were to lose this weekend, and obviously then they have no final to look forward to the week after, and a booby prize as such, it would be a disaster.
Just to expand on that, Bernard, you mentioned that they've played some fantastic rugby the last couple of years, Leinster, but they need to get it over the line now. Do you think they deserve another European title on the basis of what they've done the last couple of years.
Nah, it doesn't deserve it, doesn't come into it in the sport. It's about the 80 minutes on Saturday and
you have to go and earn it.
Yeah, you got to earn it. Like they, and for them as well, they won't care that they won the league pulling up in terms of the regular season. They won't care that they're back-to-back in a final or that people talk about them and the quality they play. They'll measure themselves in medals and trophies. So at this stage... And like you can't say they deserve any more than La Rochelle because you know they've been there too. Whereas if it was a team come from nowhere, you could say, oh, you know, it's Leinster's time. But realistically, it's about getting it done on Saturday, and there's two teams looking to do that.
Just a word on Stuart Lancaster. He obviously spoke yesterday in terms of he's heading off to France next season. But obviously, a guy who made a huge impact with Leinster.
Yeah, he's been massive, and if you speak to any of the players, they rave about his influence, how he's made them better players, and obviously a lot of those players have done very well in Leinster and also for Ireland, and he will be a big loss. Obviously Leinster went out and got a top coach to replace him in Jack Nienaber. Leo Cullen is staying on. The machine will keep moving in Leinster, but there is a significant amount of pressure to have a trophy, particularly given that obviously the final is in Dublin.
Okay, Bernard, well, many thanks for coming in. Enjoy the game itself, and we'll have plenty more build up to the big game on Saturday during the week. Stay with us, we'll be looking ahead. We'll be starting our preview of this week's US PGA Championship.
Game on.
Golf.
Welcome back to Game On with Ruby Walsh and myself, Dave Kelly. Now we're going to start our build-up to golf's second major of the season. The US PGA Championship starts on Thursday at Oak Hill in Rochester, New York. Before we speak to former European Tour pro Remy Burns, let's hear from Rory McIlroy, who faced the media earlier today.
Like, golf is golf and it happens and you're going to have bad days and... I don't feel like wasn't really the performance of Augusta that's hard to get over. It's just more it's the mental aspect and the deflation of it and sort of, you know, sort of trying to get your mind in the right place to start going forward again, I guess. I think I'm close. I think I've made some good strides even from Quail Hollow a couple of weeks ago. I'm seeing some better things, better start lines, certainly just some better golf shots, you know, a little more sure of where I'm going to start the ball and sort of a more consistent shot pattern. So, but yeah, look, we'll get out there and see and play and, I've expect to go out there and if I can execute the way that I feel like I can, then, you know, I still believe that I'm one of the best players in the world and, you know, I can produce good golf to have a chance of winning this week.
That was Rory McIlroy speaking earlier today. We're joined now by former European Tour professional Remy Burns. Remy, just from listening to McIlroy, he seems to be making a conscious effort to lessen and almost play down his chances this weekend.
Yeah, well, I think Rory knows well. He's won enough tournaments. He's been brutal at certain times of his career, at certain tournaments. And, you know, his bounce-back ability has always been proven to be phenomenal. You know, he's disappointed at the Open last year. And then there was a long 7 or 8 months until the next major, the Masters, the one that he hasn't won to complete the Grand Slam. And he probably went in and maybe a little bit with a knife to a gunfight, whereas John Rahm and Scheffler and some of the other guys that came to the fore, you know, had played and won, you know, 3 to 4 tournaments before the Masters, and they sort of played the fall season. So, and, you know, in towards Los Angeles and Hawaii and Arizona, et cetera. And Rory just didn't really start the season off well. He lost a driver out of his golf bag, wasn't swinging the club very well. When I mean lost a driver, he had to change driver. The one he had previously just sort of became illegal because it was too much face bounce off the face. And he's just maybe struggled a little bit. And the pressure on hand to win a Grand Slam is just unbelievably massive. And, you know, it's just something that he has to deal with and probably maybe come back in the next few attempts probably and play more off-season golf, you know, the winter season, the fall season, as they call it in the States and maybe more tournaments before the Masters, you know, where normally Rory plays really well in the middle of the season when the big events are on in the middle of the majors. And I just hope that going forward he'll be able to start starting the ball online and getting that confidence, that cocky confidence back that he normally has, and I think he will.
Remy, when you look at Eastlake, or the East Course at Oak Hill, sorry, where they're playing this weekend, like, they're going to require a lot of accuracy there. How is Rory's game for a course like this?
As I said earlier, you know, it's a golf course that you can't bring a knife to a gunfight. You're going to have to bring your full game. You're going to have to be able to hit fairways. You're going to have to be pinpoint accuracy with your irons. I wouldn't worry about a short game. A short game is phenomenal. There's a lot of bunkers, treacherous bunkers, around the East Course in Oak Hill. And as we all know, Rory's one of the best bunker players in the world. But he has to start driving his golf ball well, Ruby. We all know Rory's first shot off the tee has been his bread and butter his whole life. And he's lost that shot a little bit over the last, suppose, 3 or 4 months. He hasn't been comfortable with his eye line. He hasn't been comfortable. He's aiming the golf ball. He's been hitting it left and hitting it right. Two wrongs don't make a right, where normally it might be a little right or a little left. It's a hard thing to fix. I do know that Michael Bannon had been in Florida last week with him for 2 full days. So that should really help with his golf swing, with his confidence, with his technique, with his timing. And we know Rory's a member of, I'm not sure if you do know or not, but Rory's a member of Oak Hill. His wife comes from around the corner. So we know that he's familiar with the golf course. He came here in 2013 to try and defend the PGA Championship that he won in Key Island. So he's been there before. He knows how the course plays, and he should have an advantage, but he has to bring his A game, because there's Scheffler, there's Cantlay, there's John Rahm, there's Tommy Fleetwood. There's so many players coming down the line looking to grab this title. There's a lot of players in hot form. There's a lot of players can go very low. Look at Jason Day, has been trending so well, shot 62 last week. So look at the live golfers that we have. Justin Johnson just won last week. Bruce Cupp is playing really well. Cameron Smith finished second last week as well in the live tour. So so many people hunting this major down. There only is 4 a year, and you'll have to play great golf to win this event.
And Remy, what do you think of Rory's decision to, if you like, step away from the live debate? And obviously he has been somewhat of a poster boy, I suppose you could say, for the PGA Tour. By all accounts, it came up today at the press conference, and it was shut down quite quickly, the whole live question.
I mean, he's put himself, you know, suppose he's thrown himself face forward into the mud with this. He's been getting thrown from every angle. He supported the PGA Tour to his detriment, or whatever way you want to call it. It's his new home where he plays golf. He likes the PGA Tour. He represents the PGA. He's investment in the PGA Tour, like the PGA Tour of investment in him. You know, he tries to sell the right things, but probably the pressure that over the last year and a half has taken a grip on itself. And, you know, it's like, suppose a CEO trying to run 3 or 4 companies or 2 companies is probably not possible. So Rory just has to stand up for himself. Golf is his game. Golf is what he knows. And just go out and talk with his golf clubs. That's what he has to do, instead of trying and talking in front of a, you know, huge press conference on other agendas other than his golf. And I think he's going to have to, he's delivered that speech today. I think a few minutes ago he spoke to BBC World, and he said that he's just stepped away from it. And maybe it's time that other golfers started taking a little bit of the heat. He's done his bit. He's proven that he's a PGA Tour player, and he's there for the next so many years. He plays in the PGA Tour. He's there to make history, to win golf tournaments, to try to win more majors. He hasn't won a major for like 28 majors, so he's under or 36 majors. He's under pressure to try and grab that fifth elusive major.
Well, it's a wonderful sight when Rory McIlroy is talking with his golf club, so we will all love to see that. But he won't be the only Irishman there. Padraig Harrington will be teeing it up, Shane Lowry, and of course Seamus Power. And Remy, I read an interesting stat during the week that 23 of the last 35 PGA Championship winners were breaking their major duck. Could it be Seamus Power's turn?
Look, man, I've been looking at Seamus. Seamus plays well. This is bent grass, Ruby. I don't know if some of our listeners are familiar with this grass. You know, there's certain players that play really well in bent grass. Seamus is one of them. You know, there's Max Homa is one of them. There's so many other, Joachim Yeaman. But I really, really do feel that Seamus Power has been trending. Last year he had a little small chance to get up in the top 3. He's a phenomenal ball striker. He puts really, really well. He's extremely patient. He's added 22, 23 yards on his tee ball. And with no doubt, he's a big time player, you know, like some of the others that are in the field as well. But I really do think that Seamus has a great opportunity here. He'll stay patient and he'll just topple up the leaderboard nice and quietly. And I believe that we should see him on Sunday afternoon at some stage in the back nine. Hopefully he'll be leading, but certainly within range.
Remy, what's the difference, or not the difference, what's the impact of the different types of grasses? Why does this type of grass suit Seamus?
I suppose he's learned a lot of golf in the United States. He played most of his golf, obviously, in the States. And it's just I'm not an expert on it, but I've been reading a little bit about, you know, like Los Angeles Country Club where the US Open's been played, like where we see in the Riviera is a similar grass. John Rahm puts well on it. Patrick Cantlay puts well on it. Similar grass to Eastlake in Atlanta, outside Atlanta. So there's some players put well in Bermuda. Bermuda's harder to read for some other players. I think Rory puts really well in both. I think he puts well in bent. And chipping becomes extremely important, how you judge your pitch shots. I think Shane Lowry, phenomenal chance this week with a short game. He drives the ball well. We all know how good a short game is. That sort of grass suits him as well. But it's a huge advantage to grow up playing in that type of grass and being used to that type of grass, and you know, to get feel for your short shots, your little spin pitch shots, or your long putts. Pace putting will be huge this week. There's big fall offs in this golf course. As Andrew Green done a phenomenal job in 2019. We know it's a Donald Ross masterpiece. It was changed a little bit back maybe in the sort of early 80s and 90s, and it's been changed again, and there's different green bases, different green frontages, different bunkers. There's different fairway bunkers back to where Nick Faldo won in 19... Sorry, Nick Faldo was beat... Curtis Strain, sorry, won in 1989. It was very heavy, rough, different type of golf course than what it plays now. I think it's 400 yards or 450 yards longer than what it was back then. But, you know, grass is an extremely important part. Cameron Smith plays well in that type of grass. You know, the Australian sort of... The sand belt down there, very similar. Now, it just depends as well, because we are playing in May. It'll be a little greener, a little softer, because it's coming into the summer as opposed to an August date. But it'll probably play a little bit less bounce on the fairway, a little bit maybe less bounce around the greens. But we know how some of these U.S. golf federations and PGAs can certainly firm up with firm up around the surround areas. So we'll just see how the weather plays out, but it can be a huge advantage for some players. It's it's like suppose tennis players playing on clay as opposed to playing on grass or hard court. So there are players out there that have advantages on bent grass.
Remy, you touched on it there, the date, the May date now for the PGA Championship. Of course, for many a year, it was the final major of the year. It's now the second major of the year. Are you a fan of the new date?
Personally, I loved it in August because it was warmer, it was hotter temperatures, it was, you know, I suppose everything had blossomed, everything was, you know, the golf course played firmer and quicker. To have the four majors, suppose, quick together, personally, I don't really like it, but, you know, it is what it is. I think it's nice to have the PGA in August. I suppose when we finish up at the Open, that's, suppose, the last major, and then you go into the FedEx. But suppose it's all done for television, and it's all done maybe for NFL playoffs, etc. There's TV direct when these tournaments suppose should be played. I think in August there was more people on holidays and more people available to go to the events. Although I think it's a sellout here in New York, obviously. But personally, I'd prefer to see it in August. But look, it is what it is. It's exciting for us. We have a major so close to Augusta now, you know.
And New York will play its part in it. Will the LIV players get a friendly welcome in New York? They can be boisterous.
Well, Dustin Johnson, when he played Koepka in Bethpage, everyone started to cheer for Dustin. He's a big player. You know, I think a lot of this has fizzled out a little bit. I think players have made a decision, and I think people move on. You know, it's different. You know, like, I mean, I don't have a problem personally with LIV or PGA Tour. I like to see golf. I like to see good golf. I like to see exciting golf. I like to see birdies. I also like to see the odd six or seven thrown in, or the odd guy hitting a couple of snap hooks down the last few holes under pressure. We all like to see, you know, a difference. You know, obviously, you know, the horse racing the same. If you have the horse coming over the last that falls and you jump over and you win the race, I mean, that's part and parcel of sport. And, you know, I just love to see good golf, great golf. It's sad to see some of my favourite players like Koepka, Brooks and Dustin Johnson and people like Cameron Smith, Mark Leishman, Joachim Niemann, these golfers I was a big fan of going to another tour. But look, it is what it is. But I do think New York crowds are different than most other. There is a big town, it's a big sport. Buffalo Bills close by. New York is a rough town to play sport in, and there'll be a lot of noise there, and I'm sure there will be a lot of aggro. But look, these players are used to Ryder Cups, used to playing in different parts of the world, so let's hope that the crowd behaves in an appropriate way.
Remy, we began the conversation talking about Rory. I just want to bring it back to Rory for a moment. And Ruby, I just want to get your sort of thoughts on this, because as we said at the start, it seems to me that Rory McIlroy is playing himself down a little bit. In the past, he's maybe talked himself up ahead of a major. I mean, I don't know, just be interested to hear your view on this, Ruby, in terms of when you were in a position heading into a Cheltenham Festival or a Grand National Festival, which of those particular approaches did you employ, and are we maybe overthinking and overanalyzing a lot of the pre-tournament talk when it comes to the likes of Rory McIlroy?
Well, I would always have played down, Dave, big time. You're under enough of pressure yourself, and the most pressure you're under is the pressure that you actually put on yourself, let alone what's outside. So by talking yourself up, to me, you're always only creating the chance of a bigger fall. So I always went for the downside. And like Remy was saying, let the golfing do the talking. You have to do interviews. In a higher profile, you become like Rory McIlroy is, the more it's expected of you to be on media duty. But I would be all for the flat, bland answers he gave us today. Talking himself down, talk the golf down, talk everybody else up. Disperse the pressure, put it on other people. And that's a mind game too. I would be putting way more pressure on the opposition than I ever put on myself, or trying to. And that's what I'd be doing if I was Rory McIlroy. Remy, would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think you have to compartmentalise things. He has to put different things in different compartments, and he's probably had everything in one compartment over the last year. A lot of this was probably put on to him or asked of him, but I think it's time for him to be himself now. We all know he's one of the best golfers in the world. He knows he can win. He knows he's been number one in the world not so long ago. A few months, a few bad scores here and there. And, you know, over the years, Rory's very dangerous when he's down in the dumps. He's very, very good at bringing himself up. And don't you be surprised. All it takes with Rory is one or two swings, and he starts feeling the slot. And when he starts feeling the slot in golf, that golf ball will take off. And we all know how good he's putting and how good he's chipping. He just has to start hitting the ball on his eye line. When he starts doing that, you watch out. The rest of them will be in big trouble.
Well, maybe that elusive fifth major will arrive for Rory McIlroy on Sunday evening. Remy, it's been great talking to you. Enjoy the tournament.
Game on.
European football.
Welcome back to Game On, where our attention is going to turn to European football and tonight's Champions League fixture semi-final between Inter Milan and AC Milan at the San Siro. Mark Langdon joins us on the line. Mark, it's one of the great, I don't know, not anomalies in sport that these two share a stadium, and how do you call one an away game and the other a home game?
Yeah, it is true. You know, what is home advantage? One of the sort of big conundrums really in football and in other sports. You know, why do teams tend to perform so much better at home than they do away? Is it the home comforts of a dressing room? Is it the crowd noise? You know, does that impact on the referee? I think there's probably lots of little things that just add up to one sort of bigger thing, really. So, you know, there'll be a tiny bit of home comforts, a little bit of referee influence in there and stuff like that. For these games in the Milan Derby, you know, there'll be more supporters from Inter there tonight. They both have their own ends of the stadium, if you like. So it won't feel like an away game for Milan in many ways, but obviously there will be more Inter supporters there. But probably even more important is the fact they've got this 2-0 lead.
And some significant team news in regarding the game tonight. Rafael Leao starting for Milan, which is certainly good news. He was missed last weekend. And just, Mark, you mentioned the fact that tonight is officially the home leg for Inter, so certainly they will have a lot more supporters inside the ground. I know the AC Milan fans were particularly almost distraught after last weekend, and they lost in the league at the weekend as well.
Oh, that yeah, they did, and the ultras, the kind of hardcore supporters, were had a chat with the players. I think it's fair to say on the sidelines after the game, they did say that it wasn't a case of them, you know, being overly aggressive. They were just trying to G the players up. They then appeared at training this week to show them even more support. But it was something you don't see, certainly, in sort of Premier League football, where supporters are able to have that much influence, really, in terms of the players having to go over and kind of explain their recent results. But you're absolutely right about Rafael Leão and his influence on this Milan team. If you look at the games he hasn't started this season, there have been 12 of them, and Milan have only won one of those games. And even in that one, he came on as a substitute. So he was massively missed last week. The problem is that Leão's great strength is in counter-attacking. He's one of the best counter-attacking forwards in world football. The problem is, will Milan get the opportunity to counter-attack, because they're already two goals behind? And so there might not be that space behind the Inter defence that, you know, Leão is so famed for kind of exploiting. So he was just a huge miss last week. He's the one player in that sort of Milan team that you feel has got the potential to maybe cause an upset. And we've seen some, you know, absolutely amazing Champions League comebacks down the years. Not too many in this season's competition. You never know. Maybe it'll come tonight. I don't think so, but you never know.
That's obviously a two-goal turnaround required, but the playoffs are on tonight as well. Luton Town versus Sunderland. Luton are 2-1 down after the first leg, even though they finished 11 points clear of Sunderland in the Championship. Will they turn it around?
They've got a better chance of turning it around, because Sunderland have got a lot of injuries. But Tony Mowbray's team just keep on winning. You know, they kind of free rolling at this stage, because they just sneaked in to the playoffs. As you say, Luton were third and quite rightly finished third in the Championship table. All the pressure, despite them being a smaller club than Sunderland, the pressure's kind of on Luton. I think at Kenilworth Road they might be able to turn it around. I wouldn't be surprised if that one went all the way. You know, Luton maybe win by one goal on the night and we end up with extra time and penalties. I think it'd be a very close one, certainly closer than the Champions League semi-final.
Mark, we have to mention Barcelona's first league title this century without Lionel Messi, wrapped up at the weekend, four games still to play. Barca 14 points clear. They could reach 97 points, which would be the third highest ever points total in Spain. The manager, Xavi, however, keen to stress that this is a very different Barcelona and we're in a different Barcelona era.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Xavi, really. It wasn't and hasn't been done with the same kind of swagger that maybe Pep Guardiola's Barcelona teams did it previously, or even the Luis Enrique one that had Messi, Neymar and Luis Suarez up front. This has been a much more functional Barcelona team. So Stegen, the goalkeeper, probably been one of the standout performers for them. I also think that Real Madrid have been distracted by Champions League. Atletico Madrid were terrible before the World Cup. So that they were, in some ways, I suppose, gifted the title. But they have been very efficient. They did win it at their local rivals at Espanyol. And as they celebrated around the centre circle after the game, they were then chased off by the Espanyol sort of hardcore supporters who ran them not only sort of back into the stadium, into the tunnel area, they also tried to get into the home, into the away dressing room as well. A bit of context to that, Espanyol looked like they're about to be relegated. So there's a lot of angst in terms of, the supporters not happy with how their club's been run, and they're not happy with Barcelona's players celebrating on their turf at the end of the game.
What were they supposed to do? Walk off with their hands in their pockets?
Oh, no. I mean, it is ridiculous. I mean, the Barca players were well within their rights to celebrate. And a couple of them, Marcus Alonso being one of those, fronted up to the Espanyol supporters, who were eventually ushered away. So it wasn't great scenes. And actually, there have been a few issues around Europe this weekend, really, with one game in Holland being called off because of fan trouble as well. So and we had that incident at Leeds v Newcastle as well. So it definitely feels like that there is an issue around Europe with fan behaviour, I would say.
Yeah, hopefully it goes away. Mark Langdon, thanks a million for taking our call. That is about all we have time for this evening, folks. And Lucy Mulhall, I doubt you're still listening, but you thanked us for giving you a platform to promote women's rugby. I would say that ye are the platform that is promoting women's rugby. Dave Kelly, we'll be back with you again tomorrow night. Better the Silver's up next. Thanks to Ronan Lawler and to Laura Lee Davis. I hope you enjoyed listening. RTE 2FM.